From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the February 2016 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, The Special Relationship. This month we take you back to the 8th of February 1941, when a long and difficult journey ended with a historic meeting. Four US intelligence officials had travelled to Bletchley Park in the Buckinghamshire countryside to share secrets of their code-breaking work with their British counterparts. This was unprecedented. That meeting was the beginning of the US-UK special relationship, which, 75 years on, continues to be fundamental to both nations' intelligence operations and national security. To celebrate this anniversary, the directors of GCHQ and the NSA today met in Alistair Denniston's office in the mansion at Bletchley Park, to stand in the very spot where it all began, on a dark, cold night over Sherry. Then and now, it happened here. Also this month, we hear from GI bride Dulcie Klusman, who sorted and distributed incoming signals in Hut 14 and Block E between 1942 and 45. She was the only bride in the group she sailed across the Atlantic with who was moving to Bozeman, Montana, where she still lives today. Dulcie became a person of interest to local news outlets for a while when her story emerged. But first, in the words of the director of the US National Security Agency, Bletchley Park represents an entwined history between our two nations. The visit of both Admiral Michael S. Rogers and the director of GCHQ, Robert Hannigan, showed how the special relationship is just as important today as it was 75 years ago.
These are the gates that were the entrance to Bletchley Park during the Second World War. Mm-hmm. The UK SIGINT organisation, the Government Code and Cipher School, had moved here in August 1939 and by the middle of 1940 had started to make serious inroads, certainly into German Air Force Enigma traffic.
Yes, and the Americans who came here, I know, understood the importance of the building in their time, and I really appreciate the importance of it today. This is like the hometown for both American and British cryptologists.
Yeah. The reason, of course, for the Americans visiting here was that a series of decisions had been made by politicians in the UK and the US.
Yes.
That there should be a full exchange between the two countries on technical matters.
Yes.
Not just in intelligence, but also in things like radar, in advanced gunnery and things like that.
Yes.
And I think it's particularly important to remember that our relationship, the relationship between the SIGINT organizations of the two countries, was part of a much wider relationship.
Yes, but it had solid political support at the top. President Roosevelt had given the Americans authority to share it all, and we came prepared to share as much as we could with our new friends.
Indeed. And it was
My name is David A. Hatch. I'm the historian for the National Security Agency in the United States. In the 1930s, the United States cryptologic services exploited Japanese diplomatic communications and were working without much success against Japanese Navy communications. While the United States cryptologic service was interested in all the Axis powers, they looked at German communications, they looked at Italian communications, it was pretty clear that if war came to the United States, it would be against Japan. So the service cryptologic agencies began dealing with Japanese communications. The Army had the greatest success in the 1930s. They solved Japanese diplomatic communications, which were enciphered by a sophisticated machine. The Americans, in addition to solving this Japanese crypto system, developed and devised a machine that could analyze these communications automatically. This device enabled the Americans to read Japanese diplomatic communications on a near real-time basis. The U.S. Army, in working against Japanese diplomatic communications, nicknamed those communications Purple. when they devised a machine for automatic solution of these communications, they called it the purple analog. In 1940, the United States was neutral. Most Americans hoped to stay out of the wars that were raging in Europe and Asia. The United States military was weak. It was small. It was ill-equipped. Most Americans did not envision going to war again the way they had in 1918. However, President Franklin Roosevelt recognized the United States was not going to be able to stay out of the war. We had to prepare ourselves militarily. We had to find allies. He sent envoys to the United Kingdom to find out not only that the British would never surrender to the Nazis, but that they did have the means to continue to resist.
What is the answer that I shall give in your name to this great man, the thrice chosen head of a nation of 130 millions? Here is the answer which I will give to President Roosevelt. Put your confidence in us. Give us your faith and your blessing. And under Providence, all will be well. We shall not fail or falter. We shall not weaken or tire. Neither the sudden shock of battle nor the long-drawn trials of vigilance and exertion will wear us down. Give us the tools, and we will finish the job.
Once convinced of that, Roosevelt saw that it was in America's interest to support the British. The British were fighting America's fight, a fight we were not ready for. To this end, he authorized discussions between the military experts of the American Army and Navy with their equivalents in the British Army and Navy. During these conferences, which a number of agreements were reached about sharing bases or obsolete destroyers, a number of support measures that could be done immediately. In the midst of this, the American and British technical negotiators suggested, how about exchanging information about cryptology? This was a radical idea, and in the United States, it had to go straight to the president, who agreed that it was a good idea, that it was something we could share, something that would benefit both countries. In the United States Army and Navy, there were in each service small cryptologic units. They were numerically small, but the practitioners were highly professional. They were brilliant people. They developed new analytic techniques, both to protect American communications from enemy cryptanalysts and to solve enemy messages. It was in this context that a number of Americans, two from the Army, two from the Navy, were selected to make contact with the British. Once the political agreements had been reached that allowed this to happen, these four Americans were chosen to travel to the United Kingdom and begin sharing to the extent determined by the relationship as it developed.
My name's Tony Comer. I'm the departmental historian at GCHQ. The irony, of course, is that once the decision had been taken to invite the American cryptanalysts to Bletchley Park, there was nothing really for the people at Bletchley Park to do other than sit and wait. All the arrangements for the travel were made by the Secret Intelligence Service, and all the people at Bletchley Park knew was that the Americans were due to travel on HMS King George V after it had dropped Lord Halifax in Washington to become the new British ambassador. You can imagine the problems that people had here at Bletchley, wondering when these people were ever going to arrive.
The Americans traveled in a British convoy across the Atlantic and were landed in Scapa Flow. The original plan was for the Americans to fly from the Orkneys down to London. However, the crates of cryptoanalytic devices that the Americans had brought would not fit in the designated airplanes, So they had to travel along the east coast of Britain by ship. While they were traveling, this ship was attacked by German aircraft. It was heavily strafed. In addition to the distress caused to the cryptologists, this had an interesting after effect. They were not the first, but they were among the first Americans to come under German fire. When they returned to the United States, not only could they share the cryptanalytic information that they exchanged with the British, but they could talk about the danger, about the urgency, about the threats to convoys as they had sailed across the ocean, and most chilling of all, of being under German air attack. They were landed in London. They were taken overland to Bletchley Park. They were tired. They were perhaps frightened. They were cold and a little bit wet, perhaps, but a warm welcome awaited them at Bletchley Park. They were among colleagues there.
I'm walking up the path towards the mansion at Bletchley Park. 75 years ago, on a cold February night, four Americans made this exact same approach to the house. They were here on a secret mission.
I was about to say colored pencils at the time. We still did say that 30 years ago.
Here to mark the 75th anniversary of that visit are the current heads of the two countries' intelligence agencies, Robert Hannigan from GCHQ and Admiral Mike Rogers from the NSA.
What was the significance of that visit during the war by the Americans here to Bletchley Park?
It was the birth of an incredibly close relationship at a time when Britain was facing defeat, many people thought, at the hands of the Axis powers. And that trust between the two leaders, between President Roosevelt and Winston Churchill, was the core of meeting those threats.
America wasn't even in the war at that time, and each side a little concerned about the other, about, boy, this is really sensitive knowledge each of us has learned over time. Are we comfortable that we can truly share this? At the time, I compliment them on both sides' willingness to take a chance.
It was a leap of trust.
At that time, it was the trauma of a global conflict and the fight against totalitarianism and Nazism. And yet we find ourselves 75 years later in a fight, in this case, counterterrorism, but a whole broader range of interests that have kept us together 75 years later in a way that today Robert and I, as the current leaders of the SIGINT efforts for our respective nations, take for granted.
Is the relationship as close and as important now as it was then?
Oh, yes. I don't think there's any doubt. I think each of us consider the other the strongest partner we have in the world.
No one can face this alone, and there is no closer relationship than we have, and it's the rock of our security.
Yeah. Yeah. Cold, overcast, gray. All we need is a slight drizzle.
I'll let you get on with the rest of the program. Great, but thank you very much.
Thanks very much, you guys.
So, Admiral, here we're standing in this famous place. What does it feel like to be here in Alistair Denison's office?
Well, first, I am struck by just the significance of it. Who would think that the arrival of four U.S. military officers in February of 1941 would, over time, lead to the relationship that we now take for granted? And I think to myself back then, for those four individuals who showed up here that night, and as I think we've talked, it was almost midnight. They've arrived from a long transatlantic journey. They really don't understand much about Bletchley Park. They're going to learn more in the coming weeks. They don't necessarily have a full understanding of exactly why they're here. And yet, out of that grows this fundamental relationship that today we take for granted. And yet, in their time, none of that existed. America wasn't even in the war at that point. It's just amazing to me.
Fantastic. And today, of course, we run Bletchley Park as a heritage attraction, encourage visitors from all over the world to come here and find out this story. What would you say to American tourists coming to UK about Bletchley Park?
I would first encourage you to come here because Bletchley Park represents an entwined history between our two nations. And it shows what our nations can do when we come together. And it also is a reminder to us that even as today we look at counterterrorism, cybersecurity, significant, massive problems, it's a good reminder to all of us that our respective nations have dealt with massive problems before. And when they work together as a team, even something like the Second World War, we can deal with this. That's a great reminder.
Thank you very much. Robert, clearly, you know, Bletchley Park is really where the name GCHQ started from. What does it feel like to be the director standing in this place today, commemorating this important event?
Well, it's a huge part of our history, as you say, and we're very proud of what happened here, proud of our staff, famous names like Alan Turing, but a lot of names who aren't famous who did incredible work alongside US and our colleagues during the war. So this is a huge part of our heritage. And standing in this room for me is a reminder of it all comes back to people at the end. You know, brilliant, dedicated people, hardworking, working together, taking risks as we have between us. And that partnership, as Mike says, is something which nothing can destroy, and it can do fantastic things against threats today as it did 75 years ago.
Thank you very much, Sir John.
It's wonderful to hear what's being said there from the United States side and from the United Kingdom side. We have worked hard here at Bletchley Park to restore as far as we can the atmosphere and the original form and furniture and everything else of this office. And it's focused everybody's minds on the fact actually what happened here. That it was in this room that these people came, just the four of them, late in the evening on February the 8th, 1941. The secretary came in with the sherry, because there wasn't any whiskey or gin available.
I'd like to state for the record, I got no sherry in
this. We don't do that now. And here they were, and they exchanged the most fundamental and important secrets and achievements at that time that either side had. And that does need to be understood. So the British side talked about the breaking of Enigma, and the US side talked about and handed over a machine relating to the breaking of Purple. These were the biggest secrets that we had, and in the United Kingdom's case, we're in the middle of an absolutely fundamental existential war. And that happened nearly a year before the United States joined the war, when we had no treaty obligations to each other at all, and we were not in any kind of formal partnership. That is telling you something about the nature of the relationship between the two countries and the two peoples. And it explains in a rather fundamental way why it has developed into the form that it takes today that my colleagues have described. This is where it happened. Come here, be here where it happened.
Absolutely. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your candour and your answers to our questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Not joined by Gordon Carrera, the BBC's security correspondent and the only journalist here today for this very special event. It's been a bit top secret, this, hasn't it, Gordon?
It has been. In true Bletchley style, there have been orders not to discuss and no leaks from me or anyone else about this visit. So it's certainly been in the spirit of Bletchley in that
way. Yes, it's kept it alive, really, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
The reason that you are here, really, is because, I mean, this is your bread and butter, isn't it? Can you just tell us why that visit 75 years ago was so important?
Well, it's so important because, I mean, firstly, of what it meant during the war and the cooperation, the sharing of information about breaking German and Japanese codes was vital. And actually, you realise just how important cooperation is in this business and how it pushed each side further and helped them in their struggle. But also, I think beyond the war itself, what's so significant about that visit is that it gave birth to something, and it gave birth to this incredibly close relationship between the two countries' intelligence agencies. And we talk a lot about the special relationship between Britain and America, but actually at the heart of that special relationship is the intelligence relationship. Yeah. And at the heart of the intelligence relationship is the signals intelligence relationship, the codebreakers relationship. And that was born at Bletchley during that visit.
We can get quite blasé being here all the time, but it's still little things like this that happen that, it's quite spine-tingling, isn't it? You realise you're stood in the room where that entire relationship and the basis of our national security for the next 75 years started.
That's right. It's quite unusual in a way to be able to, you know, in the intelligence world especially, to date something so clearly.
Pinpoint it.
To not just, you know, one date. And anyway, you'd kind of expect if it was a date, it would be a big summit meeting or something like that. But it's not a summit meeting. It's, you know, four Americans turning up late at night, you know, a few yards from where we're standing now, you know, being given a glass of sherry on arrival.
What sherry was.
Sherry was. And that was the start of it. And so I think it is fascinating just how important that meeting was. And it was important, obviously, because of what it symbolised, which was trust between those two countries. And they were both actually taking a bit of a leap of faith, but because they did, it grew into something.
It was probably a style of courtship at the start, wasn't it? Because no countries had really done that before, had they?
Yeah, one of the things, I mean, I looked at when I was researching the birth of that relationship in my book was just how, it was nervous at the start. You know, both sides were nervous about opening up, and some of the politicians were kind of, do we really want to share with them? Should we share everything? How far should we go? Should we tell the Americans about Enigma in terms of the breaks into Enigma and the bombs, you know, and that work? And there was a nervousness. And yet some of the professionals said, no, we've got to open up. And so the building of trust is part of the story. It wasn't just there like that with a click of the fingers.
And talking about your book, the name of your book?
Intercept, The Secret History of Computers and Spies. And one of the chapters is very much about, you know, the birth of that relationship here at Bletchley.
Now, it's out in the UK, but it's not actually out in the States at the moment, is it? But I think I overheard you getting your first sale.
I might have mentioned it to Admiral Rogers of the NSA that I have a book. Forgive me for a bit of salesmanship. But it's out in Britain already, but it's out in America, out in paperback in Britain in July, I think.
Well, thanks for joining us today, Gordon. And you're part of the roster of people keeping secrets at Bletchley Park.
Let's see if I can manage that. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
It's all in the right order.
Safe journey.
It was wonderful talking to you, Mark.
Thank you.
We'll see you next time.
Thank you very much, everybody. Really, it's great to see what you guys have done. I mean, this is such an important part of history, not just for our profession, and for intelligence professionals writ large, but for our respective nation, which is great to see this immortalized in a way that 20 years ago, I mean, this could have all been flattened.
Absolutely.
We would have all done something totally else. Nobody would have thought about it until the movie comes out, and then it would have been, wow, this, you know, that car park is weird.
Yeah.
And this way you're not going to be like Richard III and wind up in a car park.
No, exactly. Right.
How's it been today?
Very good. Of course, it ought to have been good. We knew it would be good. But somehow when they're both here and we see them as the leaders of those two agencies now in 2016, and we think back on that history and we can symbolize the history in the way that we have and bring out the depth, length, strength of the relationship, it is quite moving.
I think it speaks of the importance of that meeting on the 8th of February and everything that followed it. And when you look at the strength of that relationship today?
Equally, I think, just as individuals, particularly the Admiral has a huge interest in history. Like many visitors, I think they were in awe of the place. When you stand in the introductory film and it says, it happened here, they got the hairs on the back of the neck like everybody else. And standing in Alistair Denison's office in that place where this important event took place, again, they are moved like most of our visitors are.
What stood out in terms of which parts of the story they focused on and what perhaps the Admiral in particular zoned in on?
I think it was the personal nature. It was so easy in a way to personalise it and understand the scale of it because there were just four, two Army, two Navy colleagues who came across. And coming across wasn't like just getting on a 767 for a few hours. It was the journey, it was everything that they had to do to come here. You know, they knew and understood that the key event, the key moment, was the entry into the mansion, going through the same front doors, going into the same corridor, turning left in the same way, except of course there are lights on now, there was no blackout, and walking into that office where the sherry had been served at midnight. I have to admit, there was no sherry. We didn't do that. And of course, there would have been cigarettes, and there certainly aren't now. But in that office, as it's been restored, you really do get a sense of what it was like. And it brings out the point of the date, the 8th of February, 1941, 75 years, which symbolises the totemic date around which you can genuinely say this was the beginning of the special relationship and it happened and started in this very place.
On a sort of, you know, a basic personal basis, and the Admiral, I think, was very sort of taken by the rudimentary conditions in which people were operating here and taken by the whole way the place expanded over the course of time. And went away from here, I think, hopefully enthused to spread the word amongst his folks back in the States.
He seemed quite struck that it survived in the way that it did, nearly being knocked down numerous times, and now thrives as it does. He seemed absolutely thrilled that people could do what he's done today and come.
He knew some of the basic facts, of course, about how it nearly went down completely and to be replaced by a housing estate, and obviously had left an impression on him. And now he looked at what had been undertaken, what had been achieved, and of course he was interested in what our plans are for the next stage, and very strongly supportive
So of course that was encouraging, but he had the sense of history and the ability to symbolise it and represent it now. And that's what, you know, Bletchley Park is all about. There's nowhere else like it.
How important is it, or why is it so important, to get such distinguished guests to come and be seen to be here?
First level is about the importance of the story, and the particular event that we were marking is crucial in terms of British and American special relationship. But also it's important that people like this come and endorse us as a heritage attraction and recognise the fact that what we're doing here is exposing that story to a wider population. I think the fact that both the Admiral and Robert are going to go back to their organisations and spread the word is invaluable, particularly the other side of the Atlantic, and to bring American visitors here to come and see where this great relationship started. The Admiral was certainly taken by the whole ambiance of the place. You can stand in the place where history was made, and like all of us who work here, he got that, you know, shiver down the spine.
What do you hope they'll take away from today and remember?
I think they'll remember the dynamism of the place. It was dynamic in 1943, 44, 45. And that came across, of course, and it comes across through very well from what we can represent now. But they also saw the dynamism of Bletchley Park today, the energy and the achievement and the growth, the ambition for the future, which is here.
Dulcie Closement was a GI bride playing her very own part in our two nations' combined history. Before she sailed for America, Dulcie made a top-secret contribution to the war effort when she spent 3 years working at Bletchley Park. KMMS radio host Chris Griffin was beyond excited to meet and interview Dulcie and was delighted when her story spread beyond his airwaves. He told podcast producer Mark Cotton why she impressed him quite so much.
When I went to meet Dulcie, the interview that you have of me conversing with Dulcie was not supposed to be the actual interview. It was just an introductory meeting. But once I realized that with her advanced age, that conversation seemed to be going well, we just started rolling. And what you walked away was the actual first time I had met her.
I think it's the immediacy of it that makes it so wonderful. Now, you've got someone else with you at the moment, haven't you?
Yes, Aaron Schattauer, who is my digital managing editor here at the station, is actually responsible for making the introduction to the people that originally met Dulcie and brought the story to Aaron, who passed it on to me. And Aaron, maybe you can tell that part of the story, because I just got an email from you saying, would you like to interview a Bletchley Park veteran?
That's right. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Aaron.
Hi. That's pretty much exactly what happened. A friend of mine who reached out to me, I had known him during his time as a raft guide, actually, here in Bozeman, Montana. And his name is Jim Karras. And Jim contacted me, knowing that I was in the media, and asked if we would like to do a story on Dulcie. And I said, of course, I know the exact person who you should talk to. And I thought of Chris immediately and knew that he would really enjoy doing that interview and do a really great job at it.
Were you there for the interview?
I was, yes. I shot video of the interview and took some photos while we were there. And Dulcie, I mean, just the expressions on her face and the emotion that you can see while she is telling this story, just, you know, it's so important to be there capturing that, I think. And you can see it in her eyes and in her facial expressions, just her remembering all of that. You know, the story she told, she was incredibly sharp and she remembered incredible details about it,
yes.
You know, about her time there, but also her time meeting her husband and, you know, stories related to that as well.
I mean, that's what we try to get with the podcast interviews. We obviously have our official oral history archive where, you know, the questions are more about the actual processes that they carried out at Bletchley Park. But what we try to do with the podcast is try and get the stories, because basically they were just girls and they like to be called girls as well. They don't like to be called ladies. They like to be reminded that they were just girls of 17, 18, 19, really, most of them.
Mark, one of the things that sticks with me now several months removed from the conversation with Dulcie was the joy on her face discussing the dance that she invited her then beau to.
I know. And
the trouble that she got in because she used his address and he knew where it was. But also, with that same joy, as she remembered that past, bringing it more into the present when she talked about the passing of her now then husband. It was equal parts joy in the remembering of those things, yet you could see the pain that she was dealing with the passing of her husband. And that's the dichotomy of the conversation that sticks with me even now, as I said, several months removed.
We've interviewed around 50 veterans for the podcast, and there's occasionally a time in an interview, it's only happened two or three times, where a veteran will get quite emotional. It's generally when they mention the fact that they never got to tell their parents what they did during the war, which I think for a lot of them, you know, is obviously one of the things that they've had to carry all these years. And I think you handled that so well with Dulcie. You didn't push her at all. It was such a gentle interview, but you managed to get so much out of her.
Well, it's not my story to tell, and it's not my story to pry. I'm only there, and the weight of the history of what she did at Bletchley Park weighed heavily upon me. I think Aaron and I had a discussion shortly before we walked in to meet her for the very first time, where I said, I have no idea what I'm going to do here.
Well, and that's a great opportunity to just let that conversation roll, too. And yeah. I think that's why it went the way it did, was because, like Chris said, we went in there planning just to meet Dulcie and plan for the future for an interview. And, you know, it rolled naturally into that interview. And, you know, getting to know her and getting to know her story and hearing it for the first time totally spontaneously was what was really important, I think, and not staging an interview as much as just speaking with someone and asking them about their life.
And I have to add, because it was at Jim's insistence that for this pre-interview meeting that actually turned out to be the interview, that we bring all our gear along just in case lightning struck, as it did, that we were in the position to capture it.
I think some of the best ones are the ones that weren't planned. I think it's less pressure for them. One of the things that came out in the interview when you asked Dulcie about whether she talked about what she'd done at Bletchley Park later in her life when she could, I think you brought out of her something that we've seen a lot in the veterans, which is it wasn't so much that they couldn't talk about it for 30 years, but at the end of the war, they just wanted to get on with their lives. They'd put their lives on hold for, you know, some of them up to 6 years, and, you know, they wanted to have a life again. And that was the most important thing for them. And, you know, for the next 30 years, they didn't really think about Bletchley Park.
The importance of the work that the girls such as Dulcie were responsible for, you know, another one of the, it comes back clear as day when I remember the question I asked her, did the weight of your work at Bletchley Park weigh heavy upon you? And her response was, well, of course, because if I make a mistake, the boys are going to die.
Yeah. Some of them, when they had a more direct contact with the information, so with Dulcie, where she was reading the preamble, she knew, you know, well, that's going to be naval, that'll be Air Force. You know, like she said in your interview, you know, if it was naval, she knew if she didn't get that to the right person, that could be a ship sunk. And, you know, countless hundreds of lives lost.
Absolutely. Maybe you could speak to that, Aaron, because, you know, even with a conversation as indelible as the conversation with Dulcie was, I was a participant and I was so worried in listening to what she said, trying to formulate the next question. Did any of this resonate with you as an observer?
Well, I was on the other end too. I was working the camera, so it was, you know, I was kind of doing the same thing, but it just how the story rolled from her, and just how, you know, there were a few of us sitting around. She had some friends there with her as well, and Jim was there. So, you know, there were many of us just kind of, not many, but a few of us there asking questions and engaging. And, you know, there are so many questions you want to ask, and it's such an entire life full of questions that you kind of just go along with her on the ride and hear what she has to say. And that's really the best way to hear it, I think.
If we were to write a 101 of how to interview a Bletchley Park veteran, well, we'd probably just give people Chris's interview with Dulcie, because it was the perfect way to interview it. Just to nudge her along with a couple of little questions. And when they go, they just go.
Exactly.
Now, one thing I want to say, Chris.
Yes, sir.
When you originally posted this online, I don't know how far you thought this would spread, whether it would, you know, spread outside of Montana or, you know, anyone else would pick it up. What really got us was that you put a little note on your post that said, I've interviewed many, many famous people, I've never felt the weight of an interview until this conversation with Dulcie. How do I get this right? What else can she tell me? What can she tell me? Will she tell anyone else? I feel if she speaks to no one else, people will know Dulcie Kluseman because you listened. Well, I think you managed to do that, really, didn't you?
Yeah, and to be brutally honest, Mark, that's not just lip service.
No.
I did feel the weight because I didn't know that I would have a second opportunity to have a conversation with Dulcie. Unfortunately, no. That was my mindset walking into it. And I wanted to get this one right. I mean, I've spoken with Sir Mick Jagger, Sir Paul McCartney, Keith Richards, and other notable rock and rollers.
Yeah.
And you want to get those interviews right as well. But, you know, in the end, it's just music.
Yeah, this... and it's a different pressure, isn't it?
Yes, it's a very different pressure.
You've got the weight of history on your shoulders.
And just to acknowledge what Bletchley Park was, I mean, I had a vague awareness, but when I really knew that this was going to happen, that we were going to meet Dulcie, I turned in probably 8 hours of research into the Enigma Code and what Bletchley Park meant to the war effort. And many people have said that the war ended 2, if not 3 years before it would have if it weren't for Bletchley Park. So they really did something of historic importance. And to have an opportunity that somebody was there dealing with the day-to-day, I wanted to get the story right. But the thing that it evolved into was the story and the romance between her and her husband. And they eventually came to Montana.
I know. This is why we wanted to feature this interview this month, because obviously this month's episode, we're looking back 75 years to what you can really pinpoint as being the start of the special relationship between ourselves and the United States, with a meeting of four American codebreakers coming over to Bletchley Park on February the 8th, 1941. And that's where it all started. And that's the military and the governmental special relationship. But Bill and Dulcie was a personal special relationship, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it really was, because as I remember, if I remember correctly, Dulcie explains arriving in New York City and having to get to Montana on her own.
It must have been just a fish out of water coming from ration-strewn Britain, you know, especially with her family living in London. You know, she'd lived through the fear of her family being bombed during the war. To come to America after that, it must have just seemed like another planet, really.
I would absolutely agree with that. And I mean, you can hear it in her voice. Thinking back on the conversation now, it came across as she describes that trip from New York City to Montana. There's almost a longing in her voice, and it was definitely on her face, because as Aaron pointed out, throughout the conversation, her facial expressions are absolutely amazing.
We meet a lot of veterans, myself and Catherine, and I don't think we ever are blasé about it. That each veteran is special to us, and their stories are special. But, you know, like you said, you interviewed Sir Paul McCartney. You know, most people would cut off their right arm to be able to interview Sir Paul McCartney. But there's something different when you meet these veterans, because you realise what they did for all of us. You know, the service that they gave basically has allowed us to live the lives that we live now, hasn't it?
Absolutely. And I don't know, maybe Aaron, because you were behind the camera, can expand upon Dulcie and in just her persona. She was so expressive, not only in the words she used, but her entire body language.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, that struck me was just her memory of detail. You know, and standing on a balcony and seeing her later to be husband, and, you know, just she took you there. She took you right there, and you could feel what she was feeling and be right in that moment with her. And that was amazing to me, was just her looking back on that time and remembering that time. And just as their mission was amazing and it changed everything. But at the time she was, like you said, just a girl. And she was a girl who couldn't tell her parents what she was doing, and a girl who fell in love, and she knew she was doing important work. But, you know, as she explained it, she had just a couple lines to look at, and she made it sound like, you know, not that big of a deal, that she just, this is what she was doing and this was her job. And meanwhile, you know, there are other things going on. And you get all of that in speaking with her.
Definitely. I've never heard one Bletchley Park veteran that we've interviewed so far boast they're all so modest. You know, you say to them, do you realise how important the work was that you did? And it's just, you know, oh, well, you know, it's just something we did. And, you know, it's amazing how these people managed to do what they did. And we're always just shocked by how modest they are.
Well, and going along with that, too, I mean, the fact that I don't think we would have heard Dulcie's story if, you know, it hadn't happened that Jim, my friend, you know, went there and to see somebody else with his girlfriend, and they came across Dulcie and they started speaking with her, and it was kind of just happenstance that it happened and was a chance meeting. So that was very important. And otherwise, having met someone like Jim who knew, hey, this is a great story that people need to hear.
Yeah.
It may not have happened. And going back to what you were saying about being so modest, you know, I don't think she ever would have thought to reach out to someone and say, hey, I have this great story to tell.
No, quite often we have to convince them that what they did do was important. Because the work at Bletchley Park was so compartmentalised, literally one hut didn't know what the next hut was doing. And in some cases, you know, people in one room didn't know what the people in the next room were doing. They don't see the bigger picture. And, you know, we have to explain to them that, you know, they were a cog in this massive machine. But, you know, each and every one of those cogs was vitally important to get the work done.
Yeah, and as Dulcie explains in the conversation, because several times throughout the conversation with her, all the work was very hush-hush.
Yeah. That's the word. That's the word all of our veterans say, hush-hush. They all have their own ways of dealing with that secrecy. And we look at it in a way that, you know, most people gave their service till 1945 or 1946 when they were demobbed. But in a way, our veterans carried on that service until the 70s because they kept that secret quiet. And then the ones that are with us now and are sharing their stories are continuing that service because they're telling that story and they're keeping it alive for generations to come. And the more veterans that we can interview and get their histories into our oral archive means future generations get to learn about what happened. And that's something that we can now say, that Dulcie's in our archive because of you two, really.
Oh, Dulcie's in your archive because Dulcie is Dulcie. I was only the person to be there to capture the conversation and ask the next right question.
Now you're showing the Bletchley Park modesty as well. That's good to hear. Erin, Chris, thanks so much for joining me, and thank you so much for interviewing Dulcie and us being able to get together and be able to share this with our listeners worldwide.
Well, it's been our pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark. Hello, my name is Chris Griffin. The week of September 7th, I was invited to interview Dulcie Klusman, who worked at Bletchley Park during World War II, cracking in part the Nazi Enigma code. This was not to be the formal interview. This was only to be a pre-interview, but it turned into the interview when I asked Dulcie why she's waited so long to tell her story. Enjoy.
Well, I don't know. I guess I've been a wanderer and I haven't been home or, you know, in England that people were interested. And over here, you know, I think not too many people heard about Bletchley Park until it came on in the series, you know, but that was a lot of it was fake. It wasn't true to me.
Yeah, because the park came into many Americans' awareness through the Imitation Game, which was released
right.
last year.
Yes. I didn't actually see it, but I heard more about it and read about it. But, you know, a lot of people over here had never heard of anything like that, so I didn't bother to follow it. And so long ago, and with my memory, I've got memory problems.
Well, Dulcie, if you don't mind me asking, would you tell me a little about your life before you started to work at Bletchley Park?
Yes. I was born in Hammersmith, London. And then my father was on the Great Western Railroad as a fireman, firing up the engine. And we moved to Wembley, bought a nice house there. And I went to school in Alperton. And then from there, you know, when the war broke out, they conscripted the women, you know, for Bletchley Park. Mm-hmm. So that's how come I had to leave home and go and live with a couple with their two children. I mean, she didn't want me there, and I didn't want to go there, but we became wonderful friends, and when I decided to get married, even though it was rationing, they had a wedding cake made for me. So I had two wedding cakes. My mother got one, and my adopted family felt enough of me that I should have one of their wedding cakes. So they planned one, too.
When you were conscripted to go to Bletchley Park,
yeah,
did you know what you were getting into?
No. It was all highly secretive, and they wouldn't tell me anything.
But shortly after your arrival, Bletchley Park, at the, then it was referred to as Station X.
Yes, Station X.
You met with incredible success, but you couldn't tell anybody.
No.
How
highly secretive. Even my mother and dad didn't know what I was doing. I just lied through my teeth, you know, and told them a story that, oh, yeah, I'm comfortable in the billet. It's not like home, but, you know, and then I'm just doing office work, and you know how that is. I never did like office work and made humor out of it.
Mm-hmm. But you did much more than office work.
Yeah.
Are there things you still can't talk about this day?
I would never, ever give anyone where I was working, the destination, where it was at, or anything. It's so highly secretive.
Even though you were a civilian employee and not military?
Even my own mother and dad never got to know exactly, you know. Well, they knew where I was at. They knew Bletchley, but that was, they didn't know what work I was doing.
At the time, did you realize the work you were doing was of such importance? Because as I understand it, you were reading messages even before the German High Command.
Yes. And the thing was, you couldn't do much about it because it wasn't the whole thing. Like in our department, it was just the preamble. In other words, the top two lines of the message. And by decoding that, you had to decide where to send it. Put it in that tube and send it to Army, Navy, Air Force. And it was up to you to get that at the right place at the right time. Because if you sent it somewhere where it shouldn't have been, you know, maybe a whole ship would go down. We're responsible for the lives of the men.
Did that weigh on you, knowing you bore the responsibility of those men?
It did at first, but, oh, I don't know, as I stayed there long enough and got to know, you know, the ropes and that, and you knew how to keep your mouth shut, but still, you know, mixing with people, whether they were neighbors of the people I was living with, you know, like if the neighbor dropped in and said, oh, well, how do you like working at Bletchley Park, and what do you do there, you know? And then I go from there and say, oh, it isn't much. I just am given this piece of paper and there's something there that might interest me. And I told a whole bunch of lies, you know, just to get by.
You mentioned Churchill's praise for Bletchley Park. Did he ever visit while you were there?
Yes, he did. I didn't get to see him personally, but I knew that he was there because something to do with the flag, I think.
Mm.
Did they lower it? Something to do with the flag. Somebody important is here. So I checked around. They saw, yeah, Winnie. I said, well, Winston Churchill. I said, he's here. So I briefly got to see him walking from one place to another. And I never got to talk to him.
Have you realized the importance that you and your co-workers at Bletchley played in ending the war?
Well, I'm learning more and more.
It's commonly agreed upon,
yes,
that because of the work at Bletchley Park, mm-hmm, World War II ended anywhere from 2 to 4 years sooner than it, mm-hmm, would have without your work.
Yes.
And for that, I thank you.
I knew everything was highly secretive. And like I say, we were told not to discuss it with people. And the first day I went home after being, you know, put into a billet and I went home, I told my mother and dad that what I was doing was highly secretive work and, you know, not to ask me any questions. And they didn't. They went along with me. They knew in order to keep me in a safe position, And then one time, the American that I was going with, that I eventually married and had my two sons by, Bill, he had asked me if whether we're going to set up a dance in Bletchley Park, and I asked him if he would like to come, you know. And somehow or another, when I sent the letter to him, there was something I needed to know, where to meet him and all this and that. They got a hold of that letter, and they said, who is this Bill Klusman anyway? I married him eventually, had my family. But it was not my fault. What happened was, in the office, they asked us to fill in the invitation and give them the office of where it was to go. Well, I gave them Bill's APO number or something. It was not where it was. So I got called over the coals for that. But I just took it all in my stride.
Somehow I think you took it a little more in stride.
Dang, Bletchley Park. Well, I did. I went to the office and I said, how in the world did you get a hold of that? Oh, they said, you know, we sent out the girls and the office sent out the invitations. And of course, they got an answer back. Yes, they would love to come to the dance. So silly.
After the war had ended, Dulcie, and knowing the importance of the work you had done during the war,
yeah,
and couldn't tell anybody what you had done, how did you reintegrate back into society?
Well, they didn't know about Bletchley Park. They hadn't heard of it. Mm. And a lot of my friends at that time, they were doing, you know, other jobs, and they weren't interested. So I never, you know, talked about it. I would talk about where I was staying at the billet, and I would talk about, you know, what I was doing for fun and that, but I just never got into, you know, what work I was doing.
So how did Dulcie May become Dulcie Klusman and end up in Montana? I know that's a very large question.
Yeah. Well, I met him at Covent Garden. He was like, it was like he would be upstairs like that on a balcony, and he was looking down with some other Americans, and it was an afternoon tea dance, and he's looking down over the back. When I look at that railing up there, I think about it. Looking over the railing, he thought, gee, I can be choosy. There's a whole bunch of girls here. So he looked a little lot stronger, and he spotted me, and he come down the staircase, and when he got to where I was, somebody else had asked me to dance. So, of course, I went out on the dance floor. So he tried it again, and the same thing happened. This little group, the other guy asked me to dance. I went off with him. So he thought, I'm going to get down those stairs and I'm going to stand right there. And when she comes off the dance floor, I'm going to ask her to dance. He said, I tried three times to get to you to ask you to dance. And so he seemed like he was so tall to me. And I said, oh, it does seem strange, you know, you in uniform and all this and that. I said, and, you know, I'm a civilian. And I said, just what are we doing here? And so then he started telling me about his family in North Dakota and all this and that. And I said, well, I'm ready to go now. I've got a train to catch. Well, he said, before you catch that train, would you leave me your address and I'll write to you? I was not living at home in Alberton, Wembley. I was back in Bletchley Park. So I thought, oh, I'll never hear from him. So I'll give him that number.
Well, forgive me for asking, Dulcie, but was it the classic love at first sight moment?
No. It was a friendship, and the friendship grew and grew, but we went together for quite some time. I invited him to come to my parents' home in London, and my mother and dad met him, and then it was time for him to go back to America. And so, no, we got married over there, and because never knew whether things would work out. You just, marriage is a gamble, but it was a wonderful marriage.
Did you propose to him or did he propose to you?
He proposed to me.
Okay.
I know, I think he just took me for granted. I don't remember a proposal. All I know is he said he could be getting leave on such and such, and why don't you try and plan the wedding? You know, it was just something we were going to do. And it was a good marriage. I had two wonderful sons. I have one that lives here, and my youngest son passed away with leukemia. He went to Australia, and they asked for volunteers to clean up a ditch. And when he got there, he had to take off all their clothes and put his things on, but it was contaminated. So he developed leukemia and passed away.
I'm terribly sorry to hear that.
That was a sad thing. That's the way things are. We had a wonderful marriage.
So what caused you to leave the UK with your newlywed husband to head to the States? Was he transferred?
Well, he was ready to come back. He'd been over there several years, and we were married over there. And then when it was time for him to go back, when he was released, all of these, we call GI brides, they were all making preparations to leave the home and go to America or Canada, wherever they were going. So we went to the Foreign Office and signed up and then waited until they assigned us on a ship back home for quite some time before I followed, but nevertheless. I arrived in New York City and we stayed there for probably a couple of nights and we got to tour all around while we were waiting for, you know, all the paperwork to be done because everybody was scattered. Some were going clear to California. Some were only going to New Jersey. So we would have meetings, sign up, and I was the only one going to Bozeman, Montana. So they put me on the back of the train. Well, then you know how the train split up. I was left there on my own for a day and a night, I think it was, until they put me on another train that was going into North Dakota where I was going to be met by my husband. But I was the only one on that train that was going, so that was kind of a hard decision to make.
Is there anything else you would like several generations since your time at Bletchley Park to know about your work there?
Not anymore, no. They've got it all on television.
Yeah, but you were there. There's a little extra added credibility because of
but
that.
But you know, having been sworn under the Official Secrets Act, you know, it's kind of a blank in you. Well, you know what you did, and you knew you had to do it right or else. I mean, one little slip-up, if you mailed out to the wrong place, boom, you called over the coals.
Are you still in touch with any of your former co-workers from Bletchley Park?
I was until probably about a year or two ago. Well, when I send Christmas cards, I still send to a girl that was working in the office. I had made up my mind last Christmas, knowing that I was going to be maybe coming here, that I'll just let it go now. Just we've got nothing in common anymore, you know, and families grow and people pass away. So it's a whole different era.
Dulcie Klusman, thank you for your service. Dulcie, thank you for your time.
Yes, I'm glad to meet you.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, veterans and visitors who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk, find us on iTunes and Twitter, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audio Boom, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. And if you like the Bletchley Park podcast, don't be shy, write a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.